The following program is a presentation of the Flypod New Media Network. www.theflypod.com.
Flypod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Today in the studio we have Cory Doctorow. He's got a brand new book. It's a sequel to his book, Little Brother. It's titled Homeland. Cory, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell me a little about Homeland. Now, it sounds like something the government has.
It's the sequel to a novel called Little Brother. And Little Brother is about kids who, after a terrorist attack on San Francisco, confront the terrible overreaction of the DHS and the turning of their city into a police state, and decide that they need to restore the Bill of Rights to America. And they do so by using a cryptographically secure network of hacked Xboxes to kick the DHS out of San Francisco and restore the Bill of Rights. And the sequel, Little Brother, has the same kids a few years later, a few years wiser, who get involved in kind of WikiLeaks-style campaign. They're in possession of a huge amount of information, some of which is very embarrassing to the government, and particularly to private military contracts, some of whom are very, very scary. And as they're trying to figure out what to do with it, someone starts leaking their leaks.
So who are the characters in your book?
Well, the protagonist is a kid named Marcus Yalla, who calls himself Mikey. He's a kind of young technologist, very enthusiastic kid. His girlfriend is a young woman named Ange. And then his best friends are a guy named Jolu, a woman named Van, and a young man named Daryl. You don't see much of Daryl in the first book, but he's got more of a role in the second one.
Why'd you put more of him in the second book?
Well, in the first book, he's the MacGuffin. He gets kidnapped. So he spends all of the first book in jail.
Or in a dungeon or something.
In a dungeon. Well, in fact, on Treasure Island, which they call Gitmo by the Bay.
This book takes place in Nevada, the Burning Man. Something that you always go to?
Well, it opens at Burning Man.
Yes,
that's
it
right.
Does.
It takes place mostly in San Francisco, but it opens at Burning Man, and I do go to Burning Man, only for a few years now. I used to live in California, and I never went because it was always at the same time as the World Science Fiction Convention, which is kind of my major professional obligation. But my wife and I went for our 40th birthday 2 years ago and enjoyed it so much that now I'm blowing off Worldcon to go every year. There are some years when they don't conflict, and those are the years that I'll go to the Worldcon.
When you talk about the Burning Man, pretty much there it is, really dusty, I guess, according to the book.
Yeah. Well, so the Burning Man is a festival in the Nevada desert in a place called the Black Rock Desert, which is in Indian country. It's just off a reservation. It's a gypsum desert, so you get this very fine gypsum sand. It's where they used to extract gypsum for drywall. So it's this very, very powdery, light dust that gets into everything and is super alkali. It makes everything crack. And the desert's hot. It's over 100 degrees every day. And when the dust starts blowing, because it get windstorms, you get total whiteout of stinging white powdery dust in every crevice of your body. And in that place, they build a city of 50 to 60,000 people that's a kind of model of modern urban design. It's a kind of hub and spoke design where everything is close to everything else. And there's a kind of natural rhythm to it that makes it easy to find your way around. Nobody ever gets lost in Black Rock City. And people bring art. They make art and they bring art. They bring art cars. They produce huge sculptures out in the desert. They do all kinds of amazing things. And many of them are set on fire, hence the name. The rule is that Burning Man is not a place you go to spectate. It's a place you go to participate.
And, of course, no money at the Burning Man either.
Well, not entirely. But there are a few things you can buy. You can buy ice, 'cause it's very hard to make your own. You can buy fuel for art cars, which stops people from storing their own diesel, which is good. You can pay sludge trucks to empty out your RV. And you can buy coffee.
And, of course, that's what's happening in this book. Your protagonist brings coffee. It's kind of an iced coffee. Do you do that yourself?
Or I do. I'm a coffee fanatic, and so I travel a lot. I travel with my books, and I travel for speaking gigs and for other things. I was the European director of a civil rights group. I traveled to 31 countries in 3 years and was on the road 27 days a month. And so I keep my own coffee supplies. So I've got a bag of beans. I've got a grinder, a little hand grinder. I've got what's called an AeroPress, which is like a piston you use to make coffee. And I make cold brew, which is the stuff Marcus drinks in the book, which is a kind of iced coffee where you make it, instead of heating it up to make it and then icing it, you actually make it cold the same way you make, you can make iced tea this way. You put leaves in water or bags in water in the fridge and you take the bags out when you have left is really delicious. So the way I make it in mini bars when I travel is I keep breast milk bags in my suitcase because they stand up in the mini bar and they double seal and they don't leach any bad flavors because they're made out of great, you know, non-leaching plastic for obvious reasons. You grind a little coffee, put it in the bottom, you sort of top that up 2-to-1 with water, you put it in the fridge overnight, you pour it through a filter in the morning, and you end up with a coffee concentrate that is absolutely delicious. And because the water is never heated, you don't boil off all the most volatile aromatics that are in the beans, the acids that are have all those sort of chocolatey sweet notes. And so you end up with a very strong but not at all bitter cup of coffee. And it's really jet fuel. I mean, it's so caffeinated. So you have to kind of watch it because it's so delicious. It goes back so smooth. You can drink way too much of it, as I found out the hard way.
Well, you could, you know, mix that with water, I would guess.
You make it up 1-to-1 with water.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I tried that last night.
Oh, you did?
I tried this recipe. I must have put in way too much water as opposed to the watery coffee. It was pretty watery, yes.
Yeah, go with a better ratio of water to coffee.
It was a good flavor, though.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I could taste the coffee. I put like a cream in it, some sugar. Yeah. I mean, you know.
Oh, I never adulterate. It's just coffee.
Well, you know, usually I drink my other coffee black.
Right. Yeah, no, I love it. I had to leave New York this morning at 3:30, and I had 2 AeroPresses before I left the room. So,
in Homeland, you're talking about the desert. It's so dark out there, and looking up at the skies, I thought you did a great job of describing that. Is that really the first time that you've ever seen stars like that when you went to the Burning Man?
I'm a Canadian. Ah. So I'm from Toronto. We are all about the lakes and the cottages and so on. So absolutely, no. I've seen lots of nice non-light polluted night skies, country skies, but being out in the desert is different. I mean, there's something about the desert sky that's astounding. You're in this bowl of mountains and the sky is just huge. And partly it's the contrast, right? Because if you look out away from the center where all the stuff is happening, and the party goes all night and there's light shows and people are letting off fireworks. They do huge pyrotechnic shows, hence Burning Man and so on. When you look away, you're in this, and you walk out to the edge of the desert, you're in this totally silent black space with the stars overhead, and you turn around and you look back, and it's like something out of a kind of Timothy Leary interpretation of Alice in Wonderland. You turn back again and you're staring at this, you know, sort of velvety night sky. It's really something.
All right, now we have this lady. She's been waterboarding some of these kids and stuff, wanting to get information, and she's seen videotaping at the Burning Man. Tell me about her and her goons.
So she's the villain of the first book. Her name is Carrie Johnstone. She works for the DHS in the first book, and she's into stress questioning, and she's into sort of flexing her regulatory authority. And at the end of the first book, she gets her comeuppance, but at the beginning of the second book, you discover that she's gone off, and without spoiling anything, she's found a new life with a private military contractor.
You know, in the book Homeland, we see a little flash drive here just filled with all kinds of stuff that, maybe politicians, other business people, or others really don't want released. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're reading that, you're thinking, yeah, you know, we're kind of just living our own lives, and we really never think about some of the things that are out there that people don't want us to know about.
Well, you know, certainly that was the result of Cablegate. When WikiLeaks dumped all those cables, we found out a lot of sort of dirty laundry that I think many of us were pretty sad about, to learn that our governments were, you know, that we think of as bastions of freedom, were really involved in this stuff. You know, the subsequent dumps from Anonymous and Lulzsec, I think, have had lots of revelations as well. When Lulzsec dumped the email from a military contractor called H.B. Gary, we found out that the Air Force was looking for software to allow people to run 20 personas online, so that one person could pretend to be 20 different people at once online and participate in message boards and try and sway the discussion to match a political agenda. And that's so corrosive, right? I mean, to the idea that you might have a place where people are conducting a debate, and rather than participating in the debate and trying to win the day with facts and arguments, you win it through deceit. And that's how it works in China. They have a thing called the 50 cent army, which are people who are paid half of an RMB, half of a renminbi, 50 cents, to post messages that are pro-government. And so whenever anyone posts about official corruption, or they say that, you know, they don't agree with the policies of censorship and so on, they're overwhelmed by these paid stooges who go in and just say, oh, you must be crazy. What corruption? You know, this control that you're chafing about, it's necessary for our social order and so on. And it so marginalizes them. It so marginalizes any kind of democratic debate that it never takes place. You know, we talk a lot when we talk about China, their censorship, the censor wall that tries to block websites, but that's not nearly so effective as the 50 cent army. And really, to find out that the American government was creating its own AstroTurf army software, it was really disappointing, I think, for a lot of us.
Corey, you might be a good person to ask on this, and I've often wondered that, you know, the United States, at one time they had the Cold War with these other countries, and now we all seem to be getting closer together. Is the United States, the European countries, getting more socialist, or the other people, you know, other countries like the Russia and China, are they becoming more democratic?
Oh, neither. They're all becoming more corporatist. So the model to think of is Singapore, and that's what all of our countries are becoming, right? Where you have campaigns of systematic voter repression here, and the idea that money is speech and corporations are allowed to essentially go out and buy congressmen. Or you have the Russian system where billionaires can buy priority access to the road and put police lights on the tops of their cars and drive around. Everyone else has to get out of their way when they go around. China, where the Politburo are two, every senior member of the Politburo, the eight men in the Politburo, are billionaires. Essentially, what you have is like the Goldman Sachsification of the world's economies. It is neither socialist nor democratic.
When somebody reads Little Brother and or Homeland, which actually you should probably start with Little Brother and then get to Homeland, but I think they're both standalone books. What do you want people to come away with? I mean, do you want them to open up their minds to different things?
Well, so what I want people to come away with is the sense that technology has, on the one hand, the power to be a jailer on a scale that we've never experienced before, that, you know, the totalizing surveillance of being able to compromise phones and laptops and networks makes, you know, the most absurd surveillance dreams of the Soviet Union look like unambitious. But on the other hand, computers allow us to network with one another and to coordinate our actions together and to allow us to assert more freedoms than we've ever had. It's not that computers will automatically do one or the other. It's what we choose to do. And so I feel like in the old days, you know, if you wanted to find out about political causes, if you wanted to find out about technology, if you wanted to find out about organizing, you'd read books that were full of facts, because facts were expensive. It was hard to find out stuff. But now it's cheap to find out stuff. You just have to know what to search for. So I feel like by writing scenarios in which people, on the one hand, are compromised by technology, and on the other hand, use technology to make themselves more free, that I describe the scenarios that suggest the keywords that you yourself can take to a search engine and use to find out how to improve your life.
All right. Now, you know, Corey, I was talking with somebody, and they said that, first of all, you write for different people like Boing Boing.
Well, I own Boing Boing. I'm one of the owners of Boing Boing.
Okay.
And that's a weblog that has several million daily readers, and I'm one of the four people who own and edit it.
Wow. Somebody said that you sound like, on the website, and this person reads a lot of Boing Boing. Mm-hmm. She was well familiar with you, that you sound like you could be like a Ray Kurzweil.
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, well, so for the one thing, Ray is an engineer, and I'm not. Ray has invented some pretty important things, but Ray also has a view of this of technological progress that I don't necessarily share. I think Ray feels like technology will necessarily and almost on its own usher in a kind of golden era. And I really feel like the way that technology goes, the freedom that it either gives us or takes away, is something that we have to go out and grab ourselves. And so we have a different approach. I like some of what Ray does. I like his books. I've reviewed them. I interviewed him for magazines and stuff, but I wouldn't call myself kind of like Ray Kurzweil. I think we have different points of view.
Would you consider yourself a futurist?
No, not at all. I'm at best a presentist. I think science fiction has a terrible track record of predicting the future. I think when people talk about science fiction's predictive power, they say it's like, you know, it's like firing a shotgun into the side of a barn and then drawing a target around the place where the most pellets hit. Because science fiction's made a lot of predictions and very, very few of them have come anything like true. But what science fiction can do at its best is it can inspire. So, you know, Gene Roddenberry, when he created Star Trek, didn't predict the Motorola flip phone, but he did inspire all of those Motorola engineers who were Star Trek geeks to go out and reinvent the Star Trek communicator as a flip phone. Science fiction can warn. You know, 1984 has done that. Frankenstein has done that. That's an old tradition in our field. Science fiction can also turn a light on the present by making up imaginary futures. And I think of it like what happens if you go to the doctor with a sore throat and you say, like, I don't know what it is, but my throat hurts. And the doctor, she'll swab the back of your throat and touch what she finds there to a petri dish. She leaves it over the weekend. And when she comes back on Monday, it's grown into something that you can see with a naked eye, and she can tell you about what's going on inside of you. And I think we have these technologies that are sort of diffused, and each individual impact of the technology is so small as to be imperceptible. But what a science fiction writer can do is build a world, an imaginary world, not a predictive world, but an imaginary world where that technology is the totalizing force, the thing that makes everything else happen. And by building that ship in a bottle world, that imaginary world, that writer can help us understand what that technology is doing in the world that we live in today.
With Homeland, your brand new book, there are printers out there, and I didn't realize this, I guess, that print in 3D.
Oh, yeah. My wife's running a startup that does 3D printing. And there's lots of different ones. There's printers that print in plastic and metal and sugar, chocolate, sand, glass, ceramics. And there's lots of different techniques for it. Some of them will blow powder down on a surface and then move a laser over top of it and selectively sinter or melt the powder, and then blow more powder on it and raise the laser up and do it again and again and gradually build up a 3D solid that way. Some of them pipe out plastic like through an icing bag nozzle, but only it'll be like half a micron small, melted plastic, and they'll lay it around and around and build up 3D shapes that way. Some of them use photocurable gels. So if you've ever had a filling where the dentist put some gel in and then shone a UV light on it and that caused it to harden, you can do that with 3D solids. You can lay down beads of 3D gel and then blast it with UV light and cause it to cure and then just build up subsequent layers that way. And I even have been talking to a friend who's using inkjet heads to spray out carbon fiber on sheets of polyester that are then stacked up, melted together, and then dipped in a bath that dissolves the polyester, and you're left with a 3D printed carbon fiber solid that, because it's conductive, you can actually print circuits inside of it. So you print snap fit spaces for electronic components. The circuits are already laid in. You snap in the components and away you go. One of the cool things about 3D printing is that you can print intact mechanisms. So you can print like chains where the chains are linked already when they come out of the printer. So my wife's company, which is Makey Lab, which does it's Makey.me, which does 3D printed dolls. The dolls come out jointed from the printer. It's amazing.
So if we wanted more information about those dolls, about your wife's company, I'm sure she has
Makey
a website.
Makey.me. Yeah, okay. Makey.me.
Let's talk a little bit about Boing Boing. Mm-hmm. How did that start off? How come it got so successful?
Well, it started as a print publication long before I was involved with it in the late 80s, and I actually used to sell it at the bookstore I worked at in Toronto. And Mark Fraunfelder and Carlos Sinclair, who founded it, they were casualties of the... there was a great zine die-off. There was a distributor that had taken all the small press zines in the country national. And that distributor went bankrupt, owing them all tons of money, and they all went bankrupt. So they went off to San Francisco, and Mark rebooted the magazine, rebooted the zine as a blog. He had been asked by a technology magazine called Industry Standard to review a new product called Blogger, which was the first blogging software. And he thought, oh, well, I have this old domain, boingboing.net, for my old magazine. I'll try Blogger out on it. And he wrote a few posts a week and had a few readers every day, old friends of his. But then he broke a big story and he got thousands of readers. CNN put him on the news that night, and he was going on holiday the next day, and he asked me if I would guest edit. And I said, sure, because I knew him by that point. And he came back and he said, oh, you're doing a great job. Why don't you stay on board? And I'd written for Wired, and so had Mark. And we had two other friends from Wired that we invited in. And we just kept writing it. And what we focused on was writing what we enjoyed. So normally for magazine writing, you're trying to figure out what someone else would like to hear about and writing about it. We wrote about what we would like to hear about. And it turns out that there's a lot of people who want to hear about the same stuff as us. And it grew and grew and grew until we were actually paying a lot of money to host the site. And we had a friend of ours, the guy who'd actually started the Industry Standard, where Mark had written the article for Blogger about Blogger. He came on board to help us do ad sales. And we've grown into a multi-million-dollar, multi-million user business.
So how about newspapers and other magazines? I mean, they're going out of business all the time. Mm-hmm. Is this a look at the future?
Well, I think newspapers especially enjoyed a very strange moment in history that may never resurface. So newspapers were regional newspapers. I'm talking the New York Times, which is really in a class in its own. But local papers were really about the fact that people wanted to know how the football team was doing. And people wanted, and local businesses wanted to put flyers in the newspaper. And so the fact that people would buy a whole newspaper just to find out how the football team was doing, and the fact that the cheapest way to reach everyone was to put coupons in the newspaper and ads in the newspaper, drove a business that could fund investigative journalism, community journalism, things that I think are genuine goods, that are social goods that we are poorer for not having. But what happened was the newspaper was delaminated by the internet. It's now the case that, first of all, you can find out the football scores without having to buy a newspaper. Second of all, there are so many other ways to reach people than advertising in the paper. And they're better. And they're cheaper. And you make more sales when you use them. That the CPM, the cost per thousand that newspapers got, the advertising rates they could command, crashed. I mean, it's really simple supply and demand question, right? When when there's fewer places for advertisers, the amount of money that each advertiser pays is larger. When there's more places for advertisers, when the inventory increases, the amount that each advertiser is willing to pay becomes smaller. And that will never change, right? It's not, we will never have a future in which there are fewer and dumber ways to advertise. So if newspapers are going to survive, and I hope they do, they have to stop treating the fact that the advertising rates have fallen as a problem. Because problems are things you try and change. They have to treat it as a fact. Because facts are things that you accommodate.
In Homeland, of course, they stumble onto a little hut. I'm going to call it a hut. And they're playing at this game, Dungeons and Dragons. Yeah. One of your favorite games?
Well, I'm not much of a gamer anymore. I do play a very stripped-down version of Dungeons and Dragons with my daughter, who's 5. We play a very simple dice and miniatures game. We paint miniatures together. My wife is really the gamer in our family. She was a professional gamer. She was nationally ranked. She played on the British Quake team. Quake is an old first-person shooter and played international tournaments. Then she ran the game strategy for the BBC and for Channel 4 in the UK, and now she's got her own company. So she's really the gamer in our house. We've got all the consoles under the TV and so on. I recently played a game I really enjoyed called Fiasco, which is a kind of parlor game. You know, something between like 20 questions and if you've ever played the game Mafia, which is like a parlor game. But you play it with some dice, and you play it with 4 people, and the idea is that over the course of the play, as you follow the rules, you spontaneously generate your own Coen Brothers movie plot, and you kind of act it out, the 4 of you, and it's really fun, and it's fun to watch, too. It's a great game.
In Homeland, of course, the protagonists here have a flash drive just full of stuff. I would be a little worried if I had that, I would think. I would, especially after being waterboarded in the first book.
Yeah.
How did you come up to make the fear so realistic in this?
Well, I think that it's easy to feel paranoid about your technology, especially if you're involved in policy questions about technology. I mean, my friend Jacob Applebaum, who wrote one of the afterwards for Homeland, works for WikiLeaks, is a volunteer for WikiLeaks. And every time he comes into the country, they confiscate his computers, they confiscate his hard drives, they go through his phone, they look at who his friends are, they open files on them. And I think that paranoia is easy to kind of to lay out on the page. And in fact, you know, I'm touring with this book now, and it's been 10 days. It just hit the New York Times bestseller list last night. And in Seattle, on the first stop, I gave this talk about computers and trust and devices and whether or not, you know, how, whether our future would be one in which computer empowered us or enslaved us. And this woman said, you know, I feel so scared after hearing you talk. I don't know what I would do to defend myself. And I said, well, imagine that I'd just given you a talk about waterborne parasites. And at the end of it, you said, there's so many terrible things living in our water. How will I build my own water treatment facility? How will I keep my family safe with our own septic system? Well, you won't, right? How do you keep your family safe? You have an accountable government that operates policies that reflect our collective interest. And you have watchdogs and investigative journalists and citizen journalists who hold them to account. And you have politics where the taint of money is driven out and where politics are driven by accountability to voters. That's how you have it, right? And that's how you get good water systems. And that's how you get good hygiene on the internet too. That's how you get good information hygiene. And you and I, we can never, no matter how bright we are, secure all of our devices individually. We can only do it as a group.
Homeland, will this book become a three-book series?
Oh, it's entirely possible I'll write some more of it. I never thought I'd write a sequel, but not only have I written this, but the White House Office of Technology commissioned 25,000-word novella in the Little Brother Homeland cycle that they'll be publishing in mid-March on the White House website.
If I wanted more information about your other books, mm-hmm. Homeland, I'm sure you've got a website out there.
Yeah, sure. The website is craphound.com, but the easiest way to find it is if you just put Corey, C-O-R-Y, into Google. I'm the first result. So that's the easiest way to find me.
So how do you get to be the first result on
Google? You use the internet a lot for a long time.
Do you? And that's what you've done.
Yeah.
All right. Well, the book is Homeland. Of course, a little brother, the first in this series by Cory Doctorow. I just loved it when you were in the desert with the Burning Man. I felt like I was there. You just brought the whole darn thing to life. But then I kind of felt a little worried for the people, the characters in the book, that you will too. You may have even a hard time sleeping with everything that goes on in Homeland. Corey, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. I've had a pleasure. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Cover to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt, along with Cory Doctorow, author of his brand new book, Homeland. To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.